I'm Andy Bates. Thanks so much for joining us today for Faith and Family. Today's presentation is an encore presentation. Any dates or events mentioned in the program have already occurred. Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. Want to say thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University Wisconsin, for supporting this program. To find out more about Concordia University Wisconsin, just go to our website, kfuo.org. Click on the sponsor section there. Click on that CUW logo in the sponsor section. That'll take you to their page and find out all about the programs they have to offer, where they're located. Joining me by phone today, Dr. Michelle Cretella, MD, and Vice President of the American College of Pediatricians. Welcome back to Faith and Family, Dr. Cretella.
Thank you very much, Andy. I'm happy to be here.
It's always great to have conversations with you and other members of the American College of Pediatricians, and most recently a blog on the college's website and blog, Parents Should Savor the Family Table, a great article and always a topic that comes up here on Faith and Family. How have family meal habits changed over the last 3 to 5 decades? How do you think the family dining room table or the family kitchen table, how have the habits around family meals changed over these last few years?
Certainly over the last few decades, we're seeing more and more the family table just disintegrating. It's no longer seen as a time to, okay, this is a protected time, 5 p.m., let's say 5 to 8 p.m. Somewhere in there, a protected hour when mothers, fathers, and children come together as a family for not just for the purpose of, hey, we got to get sustenance into our bodies, but just to sit, relax, and become connected with one another. And there are many reasons for this. Certainly, as more families have become dual working parents, it becomes more difficult. We've seen we've gotten so far away from kids being able to just come home from school and play out in the neighborhood. It's become so much of a culture of you have to sign your child up for 20 different sports, organized sports and activities. And so what I see, I've certainly experienced it in my own family, with my own kids and husband, and what I've seen in my patients is they're trying to juggle 10 million schedules. And what has been lost is the need for connectedness. Exercise and play with peers is important for children, but in the grand scheme of things, it just pales in comparison to making family connectedness, particularly around a dinner meal, a priority.
I think in our culture in North America, especially in the U.S., when we think of when we think of physicians, when we think of pediatricians, we think, okay, we go to the doctor because we're sick. We need medicine for this or for that, or for our child. We go to the pediatrician because our child may be sick, and we want to address that. But how does the college look at children and their health? Why address topics like this, such as the family table? Why is this important to the American College of Pediatricians?
It's truly understood that when it comes to health, you have to take a very holistic approach. You have to see how relationships, particularly family relationships, impact the physical health and academic achievement and social interactions of children. So this is where the college is coming from. It's fascinating, but families who make connectedness a priority and seek this out by making the family table a priority, and they may not be able to have dinner as a family 7 days a week, but even if it's only 3 nights a week, and you compare them to families who have not made this a priority, the teens who do have frequent dinners with their families will do well. They're more likely to report getting A's and B's in school. They are more likely to report having a good relationship with their parents. They have less absences from school. for any reasons, they tend to develop healthier diets. They're less likely to be involved in drugs and alcohol. And again, it's not just the idea of, okay, we're all going to come together as a family, sit down, wolf down our meal, and get on with our lives. No, you know, it's not mad. The table isn't the magic. The magic is what's going on mm-hmm. during that meal. You have it. It's got to be a relaxed atmosphere. And for the parents, it's really about cultivating the ability to listen to your children so that they will talk, and learning to talk to your children so they will listen. Just sort of being with each other, and no pressure, mm-hmm. no set topics of conversation. Just, hey, how are you doing? What was your day like today? You know, oh, Mom, I think I failed. Mm-hmm. What are you feeling? Tell me about it. All sorts of topics may come up, but for them to be comfortable talking, you have to show them that it's safe for them to talk and that it's important for you. And that's what coming together over a meal, mm-hmm. it can bring that warmth.
So it's not only about the food and the meal. It's about
right.
opening up those lines of communication, providing opportunities for communication, which strengthens the relationships, the family bond. And so by having those conversations over the meal table, which mm-hmm. can be a relaxed environment, food, I think there's something about food that helps us relax.
Yes, absolutely. And the kids also get to see how you, how a husband and wife, how their mom and dad interact mm-hmm. over conversation, and how even disagreements can come up, and how even if voices are raised,
sure.
It can be resolved respectfully. And it's very valuable, you know, learning about relationships at the family table. It's caught, you know, it's caught mm-hmm. more than taught. So
sure.
learning about respect and it cannot be underestimated or undervalued. And that sort of, it's those qualities that make you secure, emotionally mm-hmm. secure as a child, and give you good self-esteem. And when you have good mental and emotional health, your physical health will be better. Your success in academics will be better. Your peer relationships will be better. You're going to be more likely to associate with kids with similar values and character.
So that's why,
as pediatricians, we are very attuned to something as simple as making mealtimes a high priority to get at least one meal a day. Even if it's only 3 days a week, it's better than not at all. It's mm-hmm. teaching the kids that family matters, that they matter to you. And it just has far-reaching implications.
So by the decline in family mealtimes, that means there's also a decline in family communication and the relationship between parents and children.
And without
that communication, without that strong bond, that strong relationship between parents and children, even if you're interacting, you're driving around in the car all the time from practice to practice and game mm-hmm. to game or activity to activity, it seems like those are all busy hubbub sort of times. And so
right.
the conversation is usually focused more on where you're going or what you have to do
yes.
rather than about some of the more... big picture things.
Yeah. And what's interesting is it's not that you can't talk during those times, but if you have a relaxed atmosphere at the family table, as long as the children see that you're making communication a priority and that mm-hmm. you're interested in their feelings and their thoughts and you really listen, you might be surprised. You might see changes at those other times when you are together.
Ah, mm-hmm.
I mean, I can just, in my own, my kids now, I have four children, and they range in age from 10 being our daughter, and then we have three boys who are 11, 14, and 17. And over the years, as they've grown, you know, some stages we did better with the family table than others. but if we didn't have a meal time, they knew it was important to us, and they got very comfortable talking around us, whether it was alone or even if their friends were over, or that if we had a chaotic meal time, I would notice that as I was tucking them into bed, "Mom, I have a question. Mom, can I tell you something?" So I guess what I'm trying to say is, from the family table, even if it's not every single night, every single day of the week, you will make, it'll become easier to have quality communication, if you want to call it, at other times, maybe when you're tucking them into bed, maybe even on the drive into school, if you have to, we drive our high school students into school, and two high school boys. I mean, the most common complaint I hear from parents, or one of the most common ones, is our boys, they don't tell us anything. And I'll start to ask, you know, well, what do you do as families? Do you have family meals? Do you have a family game night? And usually they don't. But those are simple ways: the family meal, the family game night, you know, turn off, no electronics. We don't allow any iPods, iPads, cell phones at the family table. There's no TV in the kitchen. If the atmosphere is open to communication, it will happen. It will come. And the kids will like it. And then you'll start to find them opening up a little more at other times.
And so by keeping those, by removing or keeping out those other very easy distractions,
right.
And by easy, I don't mean just for the kids. They're easy for us as adults, too.
Absolutely.
To slip into, you know, checking emails or checking our Facebook, checking all those things. Oh, I need to do this. I need to do that. Those things can happen at another time. There's an appropriate time for that. So what you're saying is that at the family table, remove those other distractions that the only thing that can happen is family communication and eating a meal.
And that, even that alone, that one rule about the table, and I mean, in the beginning, my husband was the one who was divorced. he used to break that just out of habit, because the poor man, he's had a late day at work, and he needs, I have to check this, that, and the other thing, and he's got no iPhones at the table. Well, the kids will say it too. No iPhones at the table, Dad. Or it's a weekend, and if I'm writing for the college, my daughter in particular will come up to me, "Mom, you need to turn that off. You've been doing this for 2 hours now. You need to pay attention to us." So it's interesting, because if parents make it a priority, the kids will absorb, the kids will catch on. They will catch on, and then they will hold our feet to the fire too. And it's a good thing. We need that sometimes.
That is important, and kids are, as you pointed out, are good at helping us stick to rules. They like
They like consistency. They like predictability and consistency. And you know, we all do. We all do. It's important to be able to go with the flow sometimes, but but there's a certain security to a basic routine.
Well,
basic rules.
And they just like to call us on it when we break the rules.
Oh, yes, they do.
Well, I have to note that, with our son, he's 15 months old right now, but when he was about, I think at about 12 months at a year, somewhere around there, he, between 9 and 12 months, when we'd sit down to the table together, he would laugh every time my wife and I would talk, every time we'd have a conversation. And
you know,
a few minutes into the conversation, he would just start laughing and giggling because he thinks it's funny when adults talk, just having a normal conversation.
Right.
He thought it was funny. Now he just kind of sits and observes quietly and occasionally chimes in with something here or there. But
it's a lot of fun. It's wonderful. And it's important, too, particularly when the children are young. I mean, when even, you know, little babies, basically toddlers, to have not to eat in front of the TV, to choose one room, you know, usually the kitchen or the dining room. This is where meals are. This is where we tune everything else out, and we just focus on ourselves and a good meal. So in terms of tips for having a successful family table, you make it a priority. You have a specific room where you will come together. And this, I have found, whether kids are in preschool or even up to my teenagers, offer, say, hey, do you want to be, not just, hey, all right, you know what, you, time, get in here, help me cook. But what I would do, because the kids might not go for that, particularly teenagers, but how would you like, well, I remember when they were preschoolers, I'd say, hey, how would you like to play restaurant and you can be my assistant chef? So from the time they were little kids, this is the little game we would play. And now even the boys who are older, they'll see me preparing a meal. And in particular, they love it if I'm making pork chops or chicken breasts and I'm breading them. For whatever reason, from the time they were little in preschool, they just thought that was the coolest thing. You beat the egg, dip the chicken, put in the breadcrumb. And they know we don't do deep frying. You know, you just do it real quick, and then you bake the rest, so it's healthy. But they still get the biggest kick out of that, and it never fails. If I'm making those meals, I will have at least one or two of them come in and say, oh, can we help, Mom? So family meals are a priority, share in the dinner preparation. And they're not crazy about sharing in the cleanup, but that is definitely part of the routine. And the conversation continues throughout the whole thing. And we also, oh my goodness, even though I always worked part-time, I would start to slip into the mom's a short-order cook routine.
Yeah.
And I did not stay there long. because that will just kill any parent. And it sets the kids up for bad eating habits too. So our general rule has been from the time they were young, you have some of everything. You have at least one bite of, yes, even Brussels sprouts. and you know, now that they are older, they complain very infrequently, or I'll hear, Mom, chicken again. But then they'll sit down and they'll start eating and say, this is really good. Oh, Mom, this is delicious. And they'll have their one green bean and their one carrot. But all these are things that if you sort of take it in stride and have a sense of humor, make the family table successful and help your kids grow emotionally as well as develop good eating habits.
So engaging them in the preparation process can certainly be key in beginning that family meal, giving them an opportunity to help with the preparation. And that can begin even the conversations that
it
may
does.
Extend
the
into the meal.
It can start, you know, right there. And then especially when they're in grade school, they're so proud. They are so proud of, Daddy, I made this with Mommy. Or actually, my husband enjoys cooking too. So on the weekends, that's sort of his or our tradition. He loves making homemade pizza, and the kids love it. And so they sort of flock around him. How do we make the dough? How do you season it? And so, yeah, it starts a different conversation. You're relaxed, you're laughing, you're having fun doing this, and then yeah, there's no telling where the conversation can go from there.
Well, you brought up a good point when you were talking about preparing a meal just a little bit ago. You mentioned making some healthy choices when you were talking about preparing, pork or chicken and breading it and the process in how you prepare that. It was important to you that they understood how you're going to do it so that it's a healthy choice. How does the family table, how do regular family meals impact or affect food choices and nutrition when it comes to the children making those choices down the road?
Down the road, children who've been involved in food preparation and the experience of having a family table are significantly less likely, 40% less likely of being obese as teens. And it's dramatic. It's very dramatic. And again, it's because of that, not just the hands-on experience, but the communication that's going on between parent and child, mm-hmm. During that time. And this isn't to say never go out to restaurants,
sure.
Never have fast food. No, of course not. You can still be together at a restaurant. You can still even have good conversation over burgers at Burger King or McDonald's, but from a health standpoint, you don't want to make that a regular thing. But
yeah, there. How has the absence of family meals or the decline in family meals affected the family? How if we continue in this trajectory of declining family meal time, where is that going to leave us?
It really ends up leaving kids more to their own devices. They will become more, if they're not with family, not at the table communicating with you, now they're most likely going to be on one of their gadgets, mm-hmm. out on the internet, texting their friends, on social media, and they're going to be getting their values and ideas about health, probably not from very good sources. And this is why we see kids who become disconnected from their parents and lack of the family table.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons kids do become disconnected. They are the kids who are more likely to get into bad habits, drugs, alcohol, smoking, and going out with just the wrong kind of peers. And we know parents who have conversations with their kids about drugs, alcohol, and sex and make it very clear to them that these are unhelpful behaviors and make it clear that the parents have every confidence they can make the choice to abstain. Those kids who hear these messages from their parents, they do better.
Mm-hmm.
They do better. They will not use drugs. They won't drink. And they will not engage in teen sexual promiscuity. So communication between parent and child is just the most important factor to that child's social and emotional health. And so if we continue to see the decline in the family table, what we're witnessing is a decline in parent-child communication, and that's bad news for kids from an emotional, social standpoint, and then because of that, they're also at increased risk of health problems from drugs, alcohol, sexually transmitted diseases. You have to be, again, it's the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
Pediatricians are not concerned. We will treat the sexually transmitted infections. We will treat the alcohol addiction, the school dropout issue. But what we really want to do is emphasize prevention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, It's that whole an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Sure. As a previous guest on Faith and Family once said, no one will care about your children as much as you do. There are people Absolutely. That will care for your children and provide for them, but no one will care for them as much as you do as a parent.
That's
and so
right.
If you want your children to carry on the values that are important to you, if you want them to lead a healthy life, then that important time that you have with them is where that's going to happen, where those things are going to be caught, as you said, where they're
Absolutely.
Going to be taught and caught.
And the children want that. I mean, when teens are asked or surveyed, even on a large scale, the teens want their parents to talk to them about hard issues, uncomfortable mm-hmm. issues. Like the drugs, the sex, the alcohol, the bullying that goes on. Kids may be afraid to bring it up on their own, but if they know that their parents are willing to listen, are interested and willing to listen, they are relieved when parents bring these issues up. Yeah, they want to hear these things from parents. They want their parents to be approachable. You know, a little empathy goes a long way. I mean, you know, when my kids were going through bullying, my husband and I could really, wow, you know what? We know how that feels. Because, you know, most kids get picked on at mm-hmm. some point. And then they feel there's a connection and you can understand. Most people, I think, even if you yourselves as parents don't drink alcohol at all, have been around others who have, you might have been in uncomfortable situations and felt pressured to do this, that, or the other thing. The kids want to hear that, you know, you've been in the hot seat, so to speak, or even if you've made mistakes and then you got back up and made the right choice the next time, they're looking for that. They want that encouragement and, they want to know, they want to be moored to helpful values. They want direction, and they need it. We know that the teenage brain is not fully mature until the mid-20s, like 21 to 25. they need parents. They need us not to give them orders, mm-hmm. but to give them guidance and our wisdom from experience. They need that.
With just a little bit of time left, what are some of the family mealtime favorites in the Curtella household? What are some of the favorites that your family likes to gather around?
Well, I would say the favorite meal is my homemade meatballs and pasta and sauce. And usually the topics, pretty much each night, everybody sort of competes with their day, talking about their day at school. My husband will usually talk about something. He'll talk about his day at work. The news might come up. It might be the weather. Mm-hmm. So I would say those are probably the most common topics. It's what's going on, in our lives that day, or certainly if it's the Christmas season, it's the countdown. My 10-year-old, the countdown to Santa Claus coming, and Jesus' birthday. Yes, it's really about Jesus' birthday, but Mommy, Santa's going to be here soon.
Well, very good. So the conversations can be just about the regular daily type things, how your day was.
Most of the time, it tends to be the regular daily grind. Yeah.
Accompanied by meatballs and pasta.
That's the best. And my 11-year-old son passed through the room and was nodding and smiling approvingly.
Well, for our listeners, you can find out more at bestforchildren.org. You can find the family table from the American College of Pediatricians. Our guest today, Dr. Michelle Curtella, MD and Vice President of the American College of Pediatricians. Thanks so much for being our guest again today on Faith and Family.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of inspiration in action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
The National Portrait Gallery is part of the Smithsonian Museums and located on the Mall in Washington, D.C. Recently, they added a bust of Margaret Sanger, founder of Planned Parenthood, to an exhibit called Struggle for Justice. Several black pastors from around America wrote a letter demanding they take Sanger's bust out. Further, they explained her documented history of black eugenics, speaking at a KKK meeting, and her communications with Hitler sympathizers. Sanger's notorious Negro Project sought to keep blacks from having children, calling them human weeds. The pastors pointed out the irony of her bust next to luminaries like Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks, people who Sanger never even wanted born.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org. And stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Jesus once said, "Let not your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you." The kids in VBS sing it so well. Heaven is a beautiful place, full of glory and grace. I want to see my Savior's face. Heaven is a wonderful place. I want to go there. And through Christ, you will. Go there, that is. Join me Sunday on Moments of Assurance at 9:15 a.m. on KFUO.
Worldwide, KFUO has been listener-supported for more than 90 years, teaching the good news of Jesus upon the cross and witnessing to the world on God's mercy. We are on AM 850 in St. Louis and online at KFUO.org, where you will find our Give Now button. It's easy, safe, and secure to give to the Christ-centered broadcast ministry of Worldwide KFUO. You'll find us online at kfuo.org.
Today's presentation is an encore presentation. Any dates or events mentioned in the program have already occurred. Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. Glad to be with you today. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Dr. Cotella from the American College of Pediatricians. I always enjoy checking in with them each month, and we're hoping to talk with them more regularly here at Worldwide KFUO. And some other folks that we like to talk with regularly, our friends at National Fatherhood Initiative. How do we help engage fathers? How do we provide support to fathers? We're going to find out from a very real and practical perspective from our friends at Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. Joining us by phone this morning, the Reverend Dr. Eric Ash, pastor at Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Dr. Ash.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And you, sir, how are things there in Beaver Falls?
Oh, things are good. It's about 10 degrees and snow on the ground.
Well, it's pretty similar here in St. Louis. The temperature seems to be dropping, but pretty chilly here. But glad that that we get to have this conversation today and talk about some warm topics.
Oh, looking forward to it.
And also joining us by phone today, Eric Visiri, from Vice President for Program Support at National Fatherhood Initiative. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for taking some time to talk with us this morning and share with us about National Fatherhood Initiative. Eric, let's start with your story. What prompted you? We have two Erics today. We'll talk with Eric Visiri first about what prompted you to get involved with National Fatherhood Initiative?
Well, it actually goes back to some experience that I had within my own marriage that kind of got me down the path of getting involved in Responsible Fatherhood and National Fatherhood Initiative. And my wife and I had actually been running into some pretty serious issues in our marriage early on. And we had actually won a registration to a Family Life Marriage Conference, of all things. And we were still fighting whether or not we were going to go to that the day of. And it was everything was covered, registration, hotel, food, everything. That's kind of the path that our marriage was headed on. And as a result of that, it really turned us towards one another. That experience helped us to appreciate the differences that we had within from a number of different levels, you know, the male-female perspective, also our personality and family of origin kind of issues. But that was really the catalyst to get involved in what started out as marriage enrichment. And we did a number of marriage enrichment programs through Mount Olive and then in our community. And at the time, I was working in retail management, and my wife had seen an ad for National Fatherhood Initiative. They were looking for a program specialist. This was about 13 or 14 years ago now. And as a result of our interest in enriching marriages and families from that perspective, that kind of primed me for being motivated to do something related to family enrichment. And the more I dug into responsible fatherhood, the more I saw that, you know, that this was near and dear, not only to my heart, but also, you know, to God's heart as well, is you know, having strong fathers as part of the, you know, overall picture in the family health.
Pastor Ash, tell us about Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. How is it like other congregations, and is there anything that makes it different?
Oh, I think we're pretty typical probably for Missouri Synod congregations in this area. I think maybe one thing that makes us a little unique is the level of participation that we have from men, both in worship attendance, church leadership, and getting active in the various boards and ministries and programs. I think if you go to a lot of congregations these days, a visitor might look around and say, well, where are the men? And I think because of the emphasis that we've had here on family and fatherhood, we're likely to see more men involved in those types of things. Just one example that comes to mind, we have a young man in our congregation, married and two children. He's teaching the preschool Sunday school class, and I think that that's kind of rare to have a man involved with children at that age in teaching Sunday school. My own experience, I didn't have a male teacher in Sunday school until I was probably in my mid-teens. And I think that's just such a wonderful role model for the young people in our congregation to see someone who is a husband, a father, and an active Christian.
What do you think might be some of the benefits of a man and a father, a husband, teaching young children like that?
Yeah, I think a lot of young people don't have a good male Christian role model in their lives. That's just something that in our culture, in our society, men have been led away from. And I think that over time, this will help young people. It'll help young men to see that, yes, I can be a Christian and still live up to the ideal of manhood. And I think it's also good for young women to see that there are fine young Christian men out there that one doesn't have to compromise with society to find good people.
Eric, you've been involved with the work of NFI, National Fatherhood Initiative, and they're in the congregation as well at Mount Olive Lutheran Church. Tell us about how you started using the resources from National Fatherhood Initiative at Mount Olive Lutheran Church, how they've been put to use there.
Sure. There are really two main components that we've used over the years in Mount Olive. There's our kind of small group ministry approach, where we've used different curricula, some from NFI and some from other, you know, great organizations and leaders out there that have, you know, wonderful tools and resources for men and fathers. The other aspect of it is what I would consider less intensive kind of programming, which in our case, we're actually blessed to have a fatherhood resource center, what we call Fatherhood Resource Center, in our greeting area. So as people are coming in and out of the sanctuary, there's a rather large 6-foot-high three-sided kiosk that is essentially a one-stop shop for fathers. A lot of brochures, as example, like we have brochures on there on 10 ways to be a better dad. There's some CD-ROMs that can be used within computers that are interactive, fatherhood skill-building kind of resources that we have at NFI that we've been able to put in a kiosk, as well as information on things that are going on in the community or even at Mount Olive that are, you know, father-friendly kind of events or specific activities for fathers. And when we originally got this started, I had been a member at Mount Olive for approximately 11 years before I was employed at National Fatherhood Initiative. And around that time, of course, I was immersed in the whole responsible fatherhood field and things that were going on in a variety of different sectors. But early on, one of the tasks that was given to me was to put together an interdenominational team of Christian leaders from across the country to get feedback on designing a curriculum and a process and a program and different strategies to get fathers more involved in the church. And so naturally there's an in-reach aspect to that where we're trying to enhance and increase the fathering skills of men who are in the congregation, but there's also an outreach component as well in that, you know, we can use some of these tools and resources and opportunities for small groups as an outreach to just fathers who are maybe unchurched out in the community as a way to bridge them into the church. And so we came up with strategies as a result of some of the experience that I had and insight that I received from pastors from all over the country on what's worked and what hasn't worked. And we put together a Christian-based version of our 24/7 Dad program, which is our most widely used secular-based program, but we created a Christian-based version of that by infusing scripture into the different sessions and topics that were covered, and kicked things off with a big event that we called Navigation Tools for Dads, and which wasn't the small group program itself, but it was just a way to get people both in the community and in the church excited about what we were doing and offering an ongoing series of like 12 sessions of fatherhood groups. And that just, you know, continued to grow. We did a couple of cycles up to a few years ago. And now we're looking into doing some things around some more small group ministry around what we call our 24/7 Dad Power Hour resources. So that was really at the beginning. It was really about doing primarily, you know, some small group ministry around fatherhood and doing some things with our fatherhood resource kiosk. And, you know, understanding that there was both an in-reach and an outreach component to what we wanted to do there.
Let's talk about it from an individual perspective and from the larger group perspective and the congregation perspective as well. Let's start with the individual. What does a man gain? What does he learn and gain or experience when participating in a group like this in a congregation that's using the going through the 24/7 Dad program, I believe you mentioned?
Yeah, at the core of this, it's really about increasing the men's self-awareness on a number of different levels. And from strictly speaking, more from the fatherhood perspective, and not so much from the Christian side, which I'll touch on in a moment. But it's really about, you know, first the man and then the father. You know, being a father is one of many roles that we have as men. You know, we can be, you know, brothers, we can be employees, employers, we can be spouses. So fatherhood is just one of many of those roles. And at the core of 24/7 Dad is helping men to become more nurturing and more empathic, to be able to see through the eyes of other people. And starting first with helping him become a more nurturing man will then, of course, flow into his role as a father. And so we start with things, the first half of the curricula starts out with things like understanding your family of origin, increasing your self-awareness, talking about masculinity, where do we get the ideas of masculinity, and are they healthy views of what it really should mean to be a man? And then as we start moving, you know, more into outward, like relationships with the mother of the child, discipline, rewards and punishment, understanding how to get involved with your child based on the ages and stages of where the child is in terms of age and development, and what's appropriate kinds of ways to get involved and what to expect children can do at certain ages and stages. Those are all very important aspects to building fathering skills and ultimately being able to see through the eyes of someone else through this fatherhood, which is a very powerful way to help build empathy within the men. And so that's at the core of kind of the fatherhood side. But then, of course, with the Christian side of things, it really takes it to, you know, to a spiritual level. What does God tell us through Scripture, you know, is our role as servant leaders of the family, and how does fatherhood fit into that? So there are a number of aspects to that, but with the 24/7 Dad program, it really does focus a lot on building fathering skills. Many times there are a lot of programs out there that would be more parenting for both moms and dads, but wouldn't necessarily talk about some of those critical issues that we face as men and fathers. And that's probably one of the other things that I wanted to mention, is that there are a lot of churches out there that have a vibrant men's ministry, but don't necessarily have something specific for fathers. And so one of the things that we do try to educate church leaders on at NFI is understanding that aspect, in that it is important to provide father-specific kinds of tools and resources and programs for men who are fathers to get involved with, because it's a different dynamic than going in and more broadly just doing things that are for men.
Pastor, from your perspective, and you touched on this earlier a little bit, how does a program like this, how does it meet needs, how does it help men, and how does it also serve the congregation as a whole?
Yeah, our congregation, even before I arrived, well before I arrived, had a emphasis on family ministry. We host a preschool. We have programs for mothers of preschoolers. We have an active Lutherans for Life group. And as a congregation, we've never been afraid or ashamed to say that the family is God's basic building block for society. Schools, churches, communities are all very important. But the home is the first mission field. If we don't teach our children to be Christian, nobody else will. And in that family dynamic, the father has a unique role as a leader and a servant. And we encourage men to be men, to make sacrifices, to work hard, to achieve, to be nurturing, providing. And so in that way, we support the traditional family. And what we see that spilling over into the congregation, that we have men in the congregation who are husbands and fathers, very active in youth events, and doing things that husbands, fathers, men would be naturally attracted to. Bike trips, volleyball at the local YMCA, those kinds of things. And so it's a holistic approach, affirming and lifting up the role of fathers within the totality of the Christian family.
And so this has been beneficial not only to fathers and to families, but to the congregation as a whole as well, helping us understand our vocations, the many vocations we've been given, but specifically this vocation of father and husband, and what that looks like on a daily basis, and providing support for each of those for us in those vocations.
Yes, along that line, we just recently had a men's Bible study. We used Coach Tony Dungy's book, Quiet Strength. And what really amazed me, pleasantly surprised me, was the deep level of caring and sharing among the dozen men or so who regularly participated in the Bible study, and the way that they could share experiences, support one another, share what they had learned through their life journey. And we talked a lot about the biblical iron sharpening iron,
mm-hmm.
and that men learning from one another. And, you know, as I probably said earlier, there aren't necessarily a lot of good role models out there for us. And when men in the church can be mentors, teachers, role models for one another, that's a great thing.
Pastor, what are some of the difficult things that you think men, especially fathers, face today that groups like this, programs like this through NFI have been helpful with addressing?
Mm-hmm. You know, as I look at my family of origin, I think men are much more involved in child rearing than they ever were before. I certainly had much more hands-on experience with my children than my father would have had with me. And so letting men know that's good, that's okay, we support that, and we can help teach you various skills with that. I think many things in our culture lead men away from families and say that's not a male role to be involved in that way. And we encourage people to be actively involved with your children in the spiritual realm, definitely, and in everything that flows out from that into other activities.
So it's helping us see this biblical view of the vocation of men, especially husbands and fathers, as opposed to the world's worldview, and helping us realize that this is what men are given to do, and that the perspective that the world gives, that men aren't involved in the raising and nurturing of children, are very minimally involved in that, is not a biblical view at all.
Yes, you know, just coming out of Christmas, we think about Joseph, Jesus' foster father, we might say, and the role that he took in protecting and caring for the infant Jesus. Something I often say is that the best thing a man can do for his children is to love his wife, love their mother. And that's a very foundational thing for a family. Often in our culture today, we know about the very high rates of divorce and pregnancy out of wedlock and things of that nature. And certainly we want to support those people. But whatever we can do to strengthen the family structure in all of its aspects is good for fathers, good for wives and mothers, and good for the children.
Eric Vasiri, hearing what pastors had to say about how the program has benefited the congregation, anything you want to add to that?
You know, I think that from the outreach perspective as well, I know that when we ran the second cycle of our 24/7 Dad Christian-based, we were actually, the majority of the men who attended were members of the congregation, but we started then to have, you know, every now and again, one or two fathers from the community come in, and in some of those, what I would consider more at-risk situations, similar to what a pastor had just mentioned, you know, coming in from these situations where they weren't even a stepdad, they might have just been a boyfriend of the girl who had multiple children with other people, and there were some, you know, situations like that where we were able to, through the 24/7 Dad program, which is also, mm-hmm. you know, strongly rooted in healthy marriage and helping, you know, understand and prepare men for that as well, you know, whether marriage is in the best interest or not, you know, at least considering that and how foundational that is to responsible fatherhood, because as Pastor mentioned, you know, if normally you can only go as far in your fatherhood role as the relationship with the mom. You know, the programs have really provided not only an inreach and a way to help fathers and men within the congregation
but reach
those fathering skills, but also to to be a great outreach opportunity as well, and to, you know, promote Christian values to the community at large.
Well, gentlemen, we are all out of time, but I thank you both for your time today. Eric, what's the website for National Fatherhood Initiative?
It's fatherhood.org.
Very good. Reverend Dr. Eric Ash, pastor at Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, and Eric Vasiri, vice president of program support, National Fatherhood Initiative. Thank you both for being my guest today on Faith and Family.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a little bit, Thy Strong Word right here on Worldwide KFUO.
You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.